Well, the military is doing its best to destroy the country. I mean, the economy has collapsed. Livelihoods for people is very difficult. They're having a very erratic economic policies on foreign exchange, and the currency has been depreciated drastically. Banking changes, interceptions of telecommunications. You know, millions have been displaced by the conflict. It's certainly a broken state, thanks to the military.
Drugs, cybercrime, people trafficking, armed ethnic groups and civil war. The tiny country of Myanmar is in crisis. The country's military rulers took power more than 3 years ago, but their authority has never been weaker. Opposition militias and other armed factions control vast swathes of the country's territory. The civil war has intensified, the economy has collapsed, organised crime is flourishing. Nicholas Koppel was Australia's ambassador to Myanmar from 2015 to 2018. He is president of the Australian Myanmar Institute and adjunct professor at Monash University. He joined me to talk about Myanmar and why the situation inside the country is worse than it has ever been. Nicholas Koppel, welcome to Meridian 100.
It's my pleasure.
Nicholas, it's been 3 years since the military seized power in a coup in Myanmar. What is going on inside the country?
Well, it's a sorry story of yet another coup. This is Myanmar's fourth coup since independence. It came in February 2021. There were elections that took place in Myanmar, and Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, had a resounding victory. I mean, a phenomenal number of seats won. And they were coming together on the 1st of February to take their seats in parliament and then elect a new president. And it was on the eve of that the military mounted their coup to prevent that from happening. But it was different from previous coups in that the public's response to it was far stronger and far more sustained than we've seen before. I mean, we're not talking about thousands of people coming onto the street or tens of thousands. I mean, it was in their hundreds of thousands. And unlike in previous protest movements, it was from the top of the country right down to the bottom. And much of this is due to the spread of the internet in the intervening period. So people are much more connected, much more aware, and much less prepared to accept a military coup. The protests took place, a civil disobedience movement, a peaceful civil disobedience movement where public servants and educators, health workers stopped working for government and started offering their services privately as well. That was fine for a few days, and after a period of time, the military decided that this was enough and it's not going to go away. And they started to deploy lethal force against peaceful protesters. So the killings began, shooting of protesters, barricades, tear gas, and it became quite bloody. Over 4,500 people have been killed and some 26,000 have been detained. The people's response, the public response then, was to form people's defense forces. So they were saying we will take on the military using force as well. They're using force against us, we'll use force against them. And they combined with a number of the ethnic armed groups which had been pre-existing in the country and in opposition to the central government, and particularly more in the border areas and areas bordering China and Thailand and India and Bangladesh, took up armed force against the military. And so we've had a heightened level of conflict. The military's response has been even more strong. They've been using aerial attacks. They've been using artillery against villages and against communities where they've either lost territory or where they believe people's defense forces are strong. It's been a very, very brutal, very severe civil war where the military is essentially taking on the population.
So the main difference, though, would it be right to say, is that whereas in the past the military have largely managed to been successful or effective in subduing the population, in this instance they have not done that the public have had 10-odd years of democratic reform, which has changed the attitude of the citizens of Myanmar to their government and power and change their own expectations. Plus you're seeing coalitions forming between ethnic armed groups and pro-democracy groups. Is that correct?
That's right. The military's tactic is one based on fear and terror.
Just to be clear, we haven't seen that before. We haven't seen ethnic armed groups and pro-democracy groups banding together to fight a common enemy.
Well, after 1988, the students who led the protest movement at that time did move to those areas on the border, but it wasn't in the numbers, and it wasn't didn't produce the same result as we're seeing today. Today, one of the marked differences is the scale, and as you mentioned, the reason for that, I believe, is that the population, after a period of, they call it a partial democracy, but greater political expression and greater internet access, and economic freedoms as well, the population just wasn't prepared to go back. I mean, they tasted freedom. I mean, there was around 2011, 12, when the reforms, just prior to the reforms, a SIM card cost something like $2,000. I mean, it's way out of the reach of the vast bulk of the population. And within a matter of years, the price of a SIM card fell down to $1. And everyone got cheap smartphone handsets from, made in China, $1 SIM cards, and they were connecting with the rest of the world, as well as with themselves. They were doing online banking, mobile money transfers. I mean, it's an incredible change in society. And I was there for part of that period and witnessed it. And I guess the military just didn't take that into account. They thought their old tactics of fear and violence would subdue the population, and this time it hasn't.
So you've got a collection of ethnic armed groups, and you've got a collection of pro-democracy groups. Roughly how many of these armed entities are there in Myanmar at the moment? I won't hold you to the figure because I'm sure it's hard to gauge, and I suspect it probably moves around a bit anyway. But how many groups are there of significant number in Myanmar at the moment, and how powerful are they, and what sections of the country do they control?
Well, of the ethnic armed organization, there was roughly 22, and not all of them were in conflict all the time with the government. And there was a peace process underway in prior to the coup as well. And a number of those groups had signed ceasefire agreements, for example. So, and not all in conflict. The number of People's Defense Forces is unknown. It's very atomistic in its character. They're formed by groups of people and by communities, and they come together to exchange information and resources and so on. But they're not under a unified command, and it's difficult to put any number on it. But suffice to say that they're having battlefield successes against the military.
Is that new? Is it new that some of these armed groups are succeeding in their fight against the military? Have they had that kind of success before?
Localized success in the past.
I ask the question because there is speculation in some quarters that the military might actually fall, and that particularly if there's significant development, say whole units from the military defect to some of these groups, that the military will be so weakened, the junta will be so weakened that it will fall to one or more of these armed groups. I have no idea whether or not that's accurate. That's a view that's out there. Do you think that's likely, possible?
The speculation has been of two sorts. One is people calculating the amount of territory, which is where the military isn't in effective control. I mean, a lot of that is rather barren land and so on, but they calculate figures of 70% and of such. I find that less convincing. More significant has been Operation 1027. So that was on October the 27th last year. And a group called the Three Brotherhood Alliance, which is a grouping of three ethnic armed organizations with support from People's Defense Forces, had very significant battlefield successes in the northeast part of the country, in an area known as Kokang, bordering on with China. And there, the defeats were quite significant, and it led to other ethnic armed groups launching other attacks in other parts of the country. And this really stretched the military because they were fighting on multiple fronts at the same time. And that has led some people to conclude that, the military is not invincible and a military victory might be possible. We haven't seen that yet. The military still is in control of the major centres, the major commercial centres of Yangon, the former capital, Mandalay, the second largest city, and Naypyidaw, the current capital. they're still very much in control of the military. So I think we're going to have to see some resistance victory, some pro-democracy or anti-coup movement victory in one of those areas before we can really speculate about a decline. The other possibility is, as you mentioned, some mass defections. At the moment, it's at the individual level, primarily amongst the military forces. They've been losing a number of people, but we would want to see, whole battalions and some senior generals defecting, I think, before there was a split within the military, which might bring about an end.
The other thing that has changed, according to the reporting, is there's been a flourishing, for want of a better term, of organised crime in Myanmar. Myanmar has always had a problem with organised crime, particularly drug trafficking, but it's now regarded as the organised crime capital of the world. Talk to us a little bit about that. What types of crime are flourishing in Myanmar? Who's running these rackets? I assume that they are being used to fund some of these groups, perhaps the government. Talk to us a bit about what's going on in there.
The main area of organized crime traditionally has been and remains narcotics. It's the world's largest producer of heroin, and indeed the main source of heroin coming into Australia, the overwhelming source. But also methamphetamines in more recent years have been produced and distributed through Myanmar. A lot of the drug running has been in areas controlled by ethnic armed groups. They call them self-administered regions. So there are parts of Myanmar which the central government does not have effective control and hasn't had effective control for many, many years. And these are considered to be now self-administered regions. And they finance themselves in large part through illicit activities. So drugs is the main one. Gambling is another one. Gambling being not permitted within China. So a lot of casinos and gambling operations have opened up on the border regions, attracting Chinese customers. And that too has provided money for other illicit activities. And the third one is the scam centers, which have been flourishing in more recent years. And these have involved cyber scams against Chinese nationals. But it's more complicated than that, and worse than that, in that it's involved people trafficking. So citizens from mainland China have been lured with the promise of, well-paid jobs into Myanmar to these centers, where they're then entrapped and required to scam their fellow citizens. And indeed, this has been quite a significant development in that China has become increasingly concerned about it, and particularly over 2023, was making a number of demands on the government or the regime in Myanmar to crack down on these and to arrest the key players. And the failure of the military regime to do so is behind this Three Brotherhood Alliance's success. It's believed that the Chinese government was aware of the activities of the planned uprising or the attacks coming and didn't do anything to stop it and saw it in their interests. So it's certainly prompted the arrest of quite a number of the kingpins involved, but others have just shifted location into other areas, particularly bordering Thailand. That hasn't been wiped out. These activities are still continuing.
We'll get to the role of China in a minute, but just if we can just go back to this organized crime, and in particular the scam factories, which, as you say, are that's the new crime type that's really flourishing in Myanmar, and it's directed not against targets in the West, which I think a lot of people have traditionally expected cyber scams to be directed toward. It's being directed back into mainland China. Do we have any sense of the scale? Do we have any sense of how many of these scam factories are in existence? How many Chinese nationals may have been trafficked into working for them? Do we have any sense, or how much illicit money they're generating? Do we have any sense of their scale?
Very difficult to put figures on it because large parts of Myanmar aren't readily accessible anymore, and they're illicit activities, so they don't advertise
And I put out an annual
their
report.
scale. But it is believed that we're talking about thousands of Chinese citizens. I should add that it's not exclusively Chinese scamming, but it's predominantly scamming of Chinese citizens.
Well, as you say, I mean, it's grown to a scale where Beijing is concerned about it, and Beijing has demanded the extradition of a number of alleged perpetrators, as I understand it, but the junta was unable or unwilling to hand over these suspects. So China worked with some of these ethnic armed groups who were in control of these territories and who did hand over some of these individuals. Now, what does that tell you about the role China is playing in all of this? Because Beijing, of course, has traditionally backed the junta very heavily. Although in this instance, of course, it's also shown a willingness to work with some of these armed groups. Is that Chinese pragmatism, or are they hedging against the possibility of a military loss?
Quite a number of people believe China is very supportive of the coup and of the military junta. I disagree with that assessment. I think that's a very simplistic narrative. If we look at a number of decision points, if you like, for example, the United Nations Security Council, where China and Russia have traditionally protected Myanmar from resolutions, the Security Council, you know, for the first time in its history, has passed a resolution about what's happened in Myanmar, condemning the arrest of the political opponents of the regime and calling for an end to the violence. Now, China could have blocked that if it was really protecting the regime, and it didn't. And similarly, also in the United Nations, there's been the Myanmar's ambassador to the United Nations switched sides to support, after the coup, switched to support the civil disobedience movement. And again, the question comes up in the Credentials Committee of the United Nations, you know, and they decided, and China is one of the 10 members of the Credentials Committee, they decided that this ambassador could keep his seat representing the National Unity Government, the alternative government. So we've got a number of signs where China hasn't been entirely backing the military regime.
Well, what's with that? What do you credit that to?
Well, I think they had very good relations with the National League for Democracy of Aung San Suu Kyi. She had made multiple visits, 5 visits to China, established very good relationships with China. And it was the previous government, which is a civilian military government, which had cancelled China's largest Belt and Road Initiative project, the Maesong Dam, a multi-billion dollar investment. It was a dam on the Irrawaddy River, a hydro dam, which would have supplied 90% of its power back to China. So they were always a bit hesitant about the military and quite comfortable with the civilian government. But China's objectives in Myanmar are fairly simple. The long-term objectives are about stability in the border areas and their Belt and Road initiatives proceeding. They've had their new short-term objective, which has been cracking down on these scam centers. And again, the military junta have failed to do that. So I don't think the Chinese are particularly happy with the coup. I think they'd be a lot happier if it hadn't happened. But that said, they do tend to operate with whichever power regime is in power. So I would say that's not so much hedging, but certainly a hesitancy about the military junta.
How much of the country do the junta control? You cited a figure of 70%. Is that 70% of the country that they do control or that they do not control, accepting your caveat around, you know, territory controlled, quote unquote, not necessarily being the best measure of authority?
Yes, I think I would repeat that caveat. I don't think it is the best measure. I think, control of the organs of the state, if you like.
I take that point, but if the organs of the state have no reach, if they have no authority in provincial parts of the country up near the border, which are controlled by these ethnic armed groups, then that's not particularly relevant, is it?
It's it certainly qualifies the significance of their control of of the major centres. And I think what's really important is the trend. And the trend is going against the military junta at the moment. They are now controlling less and less. The opposition is not being quashed and indeed is increasingly motivated by their recent battlefield successes. So it's a very dynamic situation. It's changing all the time, but it's not moving in a direction favourable to the junta as we speak.
When you say the opposition is having success, again, we're talking about a disparate organisation, aren't we? Not even an organisation. We're talking about different armed groups and different pro-democracy groups. having individual success against the military. Is that right?
Indeed, I wouldn't even characterize them as pro-democracy. I mean, it's because there are different objectives which different groups have. A lot of the ethnic groups are looking for ethnic justice. There is a push for a federal democratic union, which is a remaking of the country. And there's been statements that the old constitution is abolished and is to be rewritten, and groups are being formed to consider what that might look like at the state level, if you like, if it's going to be a federal democratic union, as well as the national level. They still have quite some way to go, but it isn't about returning to the status quo ante. No one is saying, let's go back to where we were before, the elected government from the elections of 2020, let them form government and everyone will be happy. They're saying, no, the military has to leave government. Even under the constitution, the constitution which the military claims to be operating under, although they've suspended it, provides for 25% of the seats in parliament to be held by military personnel appointed personally by the commander-in-chief. And the military in Myanmar under that constitution are not subject to any civilian oversight. These two provisions in particular, the resistance groups, the anti-coup movement, are united in saying these two things have to change. But there are many other things which different groups are calling for, and degrees of autonomy for ethnic groups is one of those factors. And as I say, it's more than pro-democracy. It's also about the shape of that democracy.
Is Myanmar on its way to becoming, or is it already, a failed state?
Well, the military is doing its best to destroy the country. I mean, the economy has collapsed. Livelihoods for people is very difficult. They're having a very erratic economic policies on foreign exchange, and the currency has been depreciated drastically. Banking changes, interceptions of telecommunications. You know, millions have been displaced by the conflict. It's certainly a broken state, thanks to the military. But whether it can pull itself together again is to be seen. I mean, it's going to require a success in terms of a battlefield success, removing the military from its role in the economy, from its role in politics. And the various groups that are fighting the military need to come to some common understanding of what's to replace it. It's going to be a fairly fractured future.
There wouldn't be too many other countries, if any, in Southeast Asia, you know, in which there is so much of the country that's ungoverned. The southern Philippines, I suppose, springs to mind. But apart from that, I mean, Myanmar would be it, wouldn't it?
Yes, it's never been a fully formed state. It's never fully come to terms with its ethnic minorities. And certainly under the period of military rule, going back decades, it's been about the Bamar majority suppressing or controlling the minorities rather than embracing them and making them feel part of a Myanmar society, a Myanmar nation. It's got to be a difficult task to secure that peace and build a new future.
What are the implications for the rest of the region? What are the implications for Myanmar's neighbours?
Well, there are an enormous set of implications. The conflicts are unlikely to spill over into neighbouring countries, and neighbouring countries are unlikely to involve themselves. So in that sense, it'll be contained within Myanmar. But there are certain very marked spillover effects. We're seeing millions of people displaced, and many seeking refuge in bordering countries, fleeing into India, to Bangladesh, into China, but particularly into Thailand. So we're getting, if you like, irregular migration flows affecting the region. Narcotics has been a problem, and it's going to be is increasingly difficult to control, and so that'll have a spillover effect in for the rest of the world, as it's the world's largest producer of heroin. And then on the international stage, you know, within the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, Myanmar's a member state, and the world has turned to ASEAN to say, you know, we support you in your efforts in trying to resolve the situation in Myanmar, but it's having a lot of difficulty getting Myanmar on board. It came up shortly after the coup with something called a five-point consensus, which the commander-in-chief in Myanmar subscribed to, initially, and then as soon as he returned to Myanmar, has failed to implement any of the provisions of the of this so-called five-point consensus. So a lot of pressure on ASEAN to do something. There are hardliners within ASEAN and others that are more concerned about ASEAN unity, believing in consensus decision-making, and think engagement is a better way. So it's putting pressure on the unity of ASEAN with these two blocks forming, if you like, on how to respond to the crisis. And it's affecting the world's perception of ASEAN. ASEAN likes to present itself as this concept of ASEAN centrality, that if you want to deal with the region, you deal through us and with us. But if they can't manage the you know the big issue in within the block, then what's the meaning of centrality? So it's got implications for international relations as well, and for ASEAN's standing in the world.
Nicholas Koppel, thanks for joining us on Meridian 100.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Nicholas Koppel. I'm Paul Maley. Please join us next time on Meridian 100.